11. They went on for 3 days without incident. 12. During the 4th period of waking, halfway through, 3/4, they didn't know. Knew only that they weren't tired enough yet to stop. There was a sharp thump beneath them. The handcar swayed, and their bodies immediately leaned to the right against gravity as the rails took a gradual turn to the left. There was a light ahead, a glow so faint and alien that it seemed at first to be a totally new element, not earth, air, fire, or water. It had no color and could only be discerned by the fact that they had regained their hands and faces in a dimension beyond that of touch. Their eyes had become so light-sensitive that they noticed the glow more than 5 miles before they approached its source. "The end," the boy said tightly. "It's the end."
"No," the gunslinger spoke with odd assurance, "it isn't."
And it was not. They reached light, but not day. As they approached the source of the glow, they saw for the first time that the rock wall to the left had fallen away, and their tracks had been joined by others which crossed in a complex spiderweb. The light laid them in burnished vectors. On some of them there were dark boxcars, passenger coaches, a stage that had been adapted to rails. They made the gunslinger nervous, like ghost galleons trapped in an underground Sargasso. The light grew stronger, hurting their eyes a little, but growing slowly enough to allow them to adapt. They came from dark to light, like divers coming up from deep fathoms in slow stages. Ahead, drawing nearer, was a huge hangar stretching up into the dark. Cut into it, showing yellow squares of light, were a series of perhaps 24 entranceways, growing from the size of toy windows to a height of 20 feet as they drew closer. They passed inside through one of the middle ways. Written above were a series of characters in various languages, the gunslinger presumed. He was astounded to find that he could read the last one. It was an ancient root of the high speech itself, and said, "Track 10 to surface and points west." The light inside was brighter. The tracks met and merged through a series of switchings. Here some of the traffic lanterns still worked, flashing eternal reds and greens and ambers. They rolled between the rising stone piers, caked black with the passage of thousands of vehicles, and then they were in some kind of central terminal. The gunslinger let the handcar coast slowly to a stop, and they peered around.
"It's like a subway," the boy said.
"Subway?"
"Never mind. You wouldn't know what I was talking about. I don't even know what I'm talking about. Not anymore."
The boy climbed up onto the cracked cement. They looked at silent, deserted booths where newspapers and books had once been traded or sold. A bootery? A weapon shop, the gunslinger, suddenly feverish with excitement, saw revolvers and rifles. Closer inspection showed that their barrels had been filled with lead. He did, however, pick out a bow, which he slung over his back, and a quiver of almost useless, badly weighted arrows. A woman's apparel shop. Somewhere a converter was turning the air over and over, as it had for thousands of years, but perhaps would not for much longer. It had a grating noise somewhere in its cycle which served to remind that perpetual motion, even under strictly controlled conditions, was still a fool's dream. The air had a mechanized taste. The boy's shoes and the gunslinger's boots made flat echoes. The boy cried out,
"Hey, hey!"
The gunslinger turned around and went to him. The boy was standing, transfixed, at the bookstall. Inside, sprawled in the far corner, was a mummy. It was wearing a blue uniform with gold piping, a trainman's uniform by the look. There was an ancient, perfectly preserved newspaper on the dead thing's lap, and it crumbled to dust when the gunslinger touched it. The mummy's face was like an old shriveled apple. Cautiously, the gunslinger touched the cheek. There was a small puff of dust. When it cleared, They were able to look through the flesh and into the mummy's mouth. A gold tooth twinkled there. "Gas," the gunslinger murmured. "The old people made a gas that would do this. Or so Vanney told us."
"The one who taught from books?"
"Yes. He."
"I bet these old people fought wars with it," the boy said darkly. "Killed other old people with it."
"I'm sure you're right." There were perhaps a dozen other mummies. All but two or three were wearing the blue and gold ornamental uniforms. The gunslinger supposed that the gas had been used when the place was empty of most incoming and outgoing traffic. Perhaps once in the dim ago, the station had been a military objective of some long-gone army and cause. The thought depressed him. "We better go on," he said, and started toward Track 10 and the handcar again, but the boy stood rebelliously behind him.
"Not going."
The gunslinger turned back, surprised. The boy's face was twisted and trembling.
"You won't get what you want until I'm dead. I'll take my chances by myself."
The gunslinger nodded noncommittally, hating himself for what he was going to do. "Okay, Jake," he said mildly. "Long days, pleasant nights." He turned around, walked across to the stone piers, leaped easily down onto the handcar.
"You made a deal with someone," the boy screamed after him. "I know you did."
The gunslinger, not replying, carefully put the bow in front of the T-post rising out of the handcar's floor, out of harm's way. The boy's fists were clenched, his features drawn in agony. "How easily you bluff this young boy," the gunslinger told himself. Again and again his wonderful intuition, his touch, has led him to this point, and again you have led him on past it. And how difficult could it be, after all? He has no friends but you. In a sudden, simple thought, almost a vision, it came to him that all he had to do was give it over, turn around, take the boy with him, and make him the center of a new force. The tower did not have to be obtained in this humiliating, nose-rubbing way, did it? Let his quest resume after the boy had a growth of years, when the two of them could cast the man in black aside like a cheap wind-up toy. Surely, he thought, cynically. Surely. He knew with sudden coldness that turning backward would mean death for both of them, death or worse, entombment with the slow muties behind them. Decay of all the faculties, with, perhaps, the guns of his father living long after both of them, kept in rotten splendor as totems, not unlike the unforgotten gas pump. Show some guts, he told himself falsely. He reached for the handle and began to pump it. The handcar moved away from the stone piers. The boy screamed, "Wait!" and began running on the diagonal toward where the handcar would emerge nearer the darkness ahead. The gunslinger had an impulse to speed up, to leave the boy alone, yet at least with an uncertainty. Instead, he caught him as he leaped. The heart beneath the thin shirt thrummed and fluttered as Jake clung to him. The end was very close now. 13. The sound of the river had become very loud, filling even their dreams with its thunder. The gunslinger, more as a whim than anything else, let the boy pump them ahead while he shot a number of the bad arrows into the dark, tethered by fine white lengths of thread. The bow was also very bad, incredibly preserved, but with a terrible pull and aim despite that, and the gunslinger knew nothing would improve it. Even restringing would not help the tired wood. The arrows would not fly far into the dark, but the last one he sent out came back wet and slick. The gunslinger only shrugged when the boy asked him how far to the water, but privately he didn't think the arrow could have traveled more than 60 yards from the rotted bow, and lucky to get that. And still the river's thunder grew louder, closer. During the third waking period after the station, a spectral radiance began to grow again.
they had entered a long tunnel of some weird phosphorescent rock, and the wet walls glittered and twinkled with thousands of minute starbursts. The boy called them Fotsouls. They saw things in a kind of eerie horror house surreality. The brute sound of the river was channeled to them by the confining rock, magnified in its own natural amplifier. Yet the sound remained oddly constant, even as they approached the crossing point the gunslinger was sure lay ahead, because the walls were widening, drawing back. The angle of their ascent became more pronounced. The tracks arrowed through the new light. To the gunslinger, the clumps of fossils looked like the captive tubes of swamp gas sometimes sold for a pretty at the Feast of Reaptide Fair. To the boy, they looked like endless streamers of neon tubing. But in its glow, they could both see that the rock that had enclosed them so long ended up ahead in ragged twin peninsulas that pointed toward a gulf of darkness, the chasm over the river. The tracks continued out and over that unknowable drop, supported by a trestle eons old. And beyond, what seemed an incredible distance, was a tiny pinprick of light, not phosphorescence or fluorescence, but the hard, true light of day. It was as tiny as a needle prick in a dark cloth, yet weighted with frightful meaning.
"Stop," the boy said. "Stop for a minute, please."
Unquestioning, the gunslinger let the handcar coast to a stop. The sound of the river was a steady, booming roar coming from beneath and ahead. The artificial glow from the wet rock was suddenly hateful. For the first time he felt a claustrophobic hand touch him, and the urge to get out, to get free of this living burial, was strong and nearly undeniable.
"We'll go on," the boy said. "Is that what he wants? For us to drive the handcar out over that and fall down?"
The gunslinger knew it was not, but said, "I don't know what he wants." They got down and approached the lip of the drop carefully. The stone beneath their feet continued to rise until, with a sudden angling drop, the floor fell away from the tracks, and the tracks continued alone across blackness. The gunslinger dropped to his knees and peered down. He could dimly make out a complex, nearly incredible webwork of steel girders and struts disappearing down toward the roar of the river, all in support of the graceful arch of the tracks across the void. In his mind's eye, he could imagine the work of time and water on the steel in deadly tandem. How much support was left? Little? Hardly any? None? He suddenly saw the face of the mummy again, and the way the flesh, seemingly solid, had crumbled to powder at the effortless touch of his finger. "We'll walk now," the gunslinger said. He half expected the boy to balk again, but he preceded the gunslinger out onto the rails, crossing on the welded steel slats calmly with sure feet. The gunslinger followed him out over the chasm, ready to catch him if Jake should put a foot wrong. The gunslinger felt a fine slick of sweat cover his skin. The trestle was rotten, very rotten. It thrummed beneath his feet, with the heady motion of the river far beneath, swaying a little on unseen guy wires. "We're acrobats," he thought. "Look, mother, no net, I'm flying." He knelt once and examined the cross ties they were walking on. They were caked and pitted with rust. He could feel the reason on his face. Fresh air. The friend of corruption. They must be very close to the surface now. And a strong blow of the fist made the metal quiver sickly. Once he heard a warning groan beneath his feet and felt the steel settle, preparatory to giving way, but he had already moved on. The boy, of course, was over 100 pounds lighter and safe enough unless the going became progressively worse. Behind them, the handcar had melted into the general gloom. The stone pier on the left extended out perhaps 20 yards. It jutted further than the one on the right, but this was also left behind, and then they were alone, over the gulf. At first it seemed that the tiny prick of daylight remained mockingly constant, perhaps even drawing away from them at the exact pace they approached it. That would be a fine bit of magic indeed. but gradually the gunslinger realized that it was widening, becoming more defined. They were still below it, but the tracks were rising to meet it. The boy gave a surprised grunt and suddenly lurched to the side, arms pinwheeling in slow, wide revolutions. It seemed that he tottered on the brink for a very long time, indeed, before stepping forward again.
"It almost went on me," he said softly, without emotion. "There's a hole. Step over if you don't want to take a quick trip to the bottom. Simon says take one giant step."
That was a game the gunslinger knew as Mother Says, remembered well from childhood games with Cuthbert, Jamie, and Alan. But he said nothing, only stepped over.
"Go back," Jake said, unsmiling. "You forgot to say, may I?"
"Cry your pardon, but I think not." The cross-tie the boy had stepped on had given way almost entirely and flopped downward lazily, swinging on a rotten rivet. Upward, still upward. It was a nightmare walk, and so seemed to go on much longer than it did. The air itself seemed to thicken and become like taffy, and the gunslinger felt as if he might be swimming rather than walking. Again and again his mind tried to turn itself to thoughtful, lunatic consideration of the awful space between this trestle and the river below. His brain viewed it in spectacular detail, and how it would be, the scream of twisting, giving metal, the lurch as his body slid off to the side, the grabbing for non-existent handholds with the fingers, the swift rattle of boot heels on treacherous, rotted steel, and then down, turning over and over, the warm spray in his crotch as his bladder let go, the rush of wind against his face, rippling his hair up in a caricature of fright, pulling his eyelids back, the dark water rushing to meet him, faster, outstripping even his own scream. Metal screamed beneath him, and he stepped past it unhurriedly, shifting his weight at that crucial moment, not thinking of the drop, or of how far they had come, or of how far might be left. Not thinking that the boy was expendable, and that the sale of his honor was now at last nearly negotiated. What a relief it would be when the deal was done.
"Three ties out," the boy said coolly. "I'm going to jump. Here, right here. Geronimo!"
The gunslinger saw him silhouetted for a moment against the daylight, an awkward, hunched spread eagle, arms out as if, should all else fail, there was the possibility of flight. He landed, and the whole edifice swayed drunkenly under his weight. Metal beneath them protested, and something far below fell, first with a crash, then with a splash. "Are you over?" the gunslinger asked.
"Yar!" the boy said. "But it's very rotten. Like the ideas of certain people, maybe. I don't think it will hold you any further than where you are now. Me, but not you. Go back. Go back now and leave me alone."
His voice was cold, but there was hysteria underneath, beating as his heart had beat when he jumped back onto the handcart and Roland had caught him. The gunslinger stepped over the brake. One large step did it. One giant step. "Mother, may I?" "Yes, you may." The boy was shuddering helplessly.
"Go back. I don't want you to kill me."
"For love of the man, Jesus, walk," the gunslinger said roughly. "It's going to fall down for sure if we stand here palavering." The boy walked drunkenly now, his hands held out shudderingly before him, fingers splayed. They went up. Yes, it was much more rotten now. There were frequent breaks of one, two, even three ties, and the gunslinger expected again and again that they would find the long, empty space between rails that would either force them back or make them walk on the rails themselves, balanced giddily over the chasm. He kept his eyes fixed on the daylight. The glow had taken on a color, blue, and as it came closer, it became softer, paling the radiance of the futsoles. 50 yards or 100 still to cover, he could not say. They walked, and now he looked at his feet, crossing from tie to tie. When he looked up again, the glow ahead had grown to a hole, and it was not just light, but a way out. They were almost there. 30 yards now, no more than that, 90 short feet. It could be done. Perhaps they would have the man in black yet. Perhaps in the bright sunlight the evil flowers in his mind would shrivel, and anything would be possible. The sunlight was blocked out. He looked up, startled, peering like a mole from its hole, and saw a silhouette filling the light, eating it up, allowing only chinks of mocking blue around the outline of shoulders and the fork of crotch. "Hello, boys." The man in black's voice echoed to them, amplified in this natural throat of stone, the sarcasm of his good cheer taking on mighty overtones. Blindly, the gunslinger sought the jawbone, but it was gone, lost somewhere, used up. He laughed above them, and the sound crashed around them, reverberating like surf in a filling cave. The boy screamed and tottered, a windmill again, arms gyrating through the scant air, metal ripped and sloughed beneath them. The rails canted through a slow and dreamy twisting. The boy plunged, and one hand flew up like a gull in the darkness, up, up, and then he hung over the pit. He dangled there, his dark eyes staring up at the gunslinger in final, blind, lost knowledge.
"Help me."
Booming, racketing,
"No more games. Come now, gunslinger, or catch me never."
All the chips on the table, every card up but one. The boy dangled, a living tarot card, the hanged man, the Phoenician sailor, innocent, lost, and barely above the wave of a Stygian sea. "Wait, then. Wait a while."
"Do I go?"
His voice is so loud he makes it hard to think.
"Help me. Help me, Roland."
The trestle had begun to twist further, screaming, pulling loose from itself, giving.
"Then I shall leave you."
"No, you shall not." The gunslinger's legs carried him in a sudden leap, breaking the paralysis that held him. He took a true giant step above the dangling boy and landed in a skidding, plunging rush toward the light that offered the tower frozen on his mind's eye in a black still life into sudden silence. The silhouette was gone. Even the beat of his heart was gone as the trestle settled further, beginning its final slow dance to the depths, tearing loose. His hand finding the rocky, lighted lip of damnation, and behind him, in the dreadful silence, the boy spoke from too far beneath him.
"Go, then. There are other worlds than these."
Then the trestle tore away, the whole weight of it, and as the gunslinger pulled himself up and through to the light and the breeze and the reality of a new Ka, he twisted his head back for a moment in his agony, striving to be Janus, but there was nothing. Only plummeting silence. For the boy made no cry as he fell. Then Roland was up, pulling himself onto the rocky escarpment that looked toward a grassy plain, toward where the man in black stood, spread-legged, with arms crossed. The gunslinger stood drunkenly, pallid as a ghost, eyes huge and swimming beneath his forehead, shirt smeared with the white dust of his final lunging crawl. It came to him that there would be further degradations of the spirit ahead that might make this one seem infinitesimal. And yet he would still flee it, down corridors and through cities, from bed to bed. He would flee the boy's face and try to bury it in cunts and killing, only to enter one final room and find it looking at him over a candle flame. He had become the boy. The boy had become him. He was become a werewolf of his own making. In deep dreams he would become the boy and speak the boy's strange city tongue. "This is death. Is it? Is it?" He walked slowly, drunkenly, down the rocky hill toward where the man in black waited. Here the tracks had been worn away under the sun of reason, and it was as if they had never been. The man in black pushed his hood away with the backs of both hands, laughing.
"So," he cried, "not an end, but the end of the beginning, eh? You progress, gunslinger. You progress! Oh, how I admire you!"
The gunslinger drew with blinding speed and fired 12 times. The gun flashes dimmed the sun itself, and the pounding of the explosions slammed back from the rock-faced escarpments behind them.
"Now, now!"
the man in black said, laughing. Oh, now, now, now! We make great magic together, you and I. You kill me no more than you kill yourself. He withdrew, walking backwards, facing the gunslinger, grinning and beckoning. Come, come, come. Mother, may I? Yes, you may. The gunslinger followed him in broken boots to the place of counseling. Chapter 5. The Gunslinger and the Man in Black. 1. The man in black led him to an ancient killing ground to make palaver. The gunslinger knew it immediately, a Golgotha, place of the skull. And bleached skulls stared blandly up at them, cattle, coyotes, deer, rabbits, bumbler. Here the alabaster xylophone of a hen pheasant killed as she fed. There the tiny, delicate bones of a mole, perhaps killed for pleasure by a wild dog. The Golgotha was a bowl indented into the descending slope of the mountain, and below, in easier altitudes, the gunslinger could see Joshua trees and scrub firs. The sky overhead was a softer blue than he had seen for a 12-month, and there was an indefinable something that spoke of the sea in the not-too-great distance. "I am in the west, Cuthbert," he thought wonderingly. "If this is not mid-world, it's close by." The man in black sat on an ancient ironwood log. His boots were powdered white with dust and the uneasy bone meal of this place. He had put his hood up again, but the gunslinger could see the square shape of his chin clearly and the shading of his jaw. The shadowed lips twitched in a smile. "Gather wood, gunslinger. This side of the mountain is gentle. But at this altitude, the cold still may put a knife in one's belly, and this is a place of death, eh?" "I'll kill you," the gunslinger said. "No, you won't. You can't. But you can gather wood to remember your Isaac." The gunslinger had no understanding of the reference. He went wordlessly and gathered wood like a common cook's boy. The pickings were slim. There was no devil grass on this side, and the ironwood would not burn. It had become stone. He returned finally with a large armload of likely sticks, powdered and dusted with disintegrated bone, as if dipped in flour. The sun had sunk beyond the highest Joshua trees and had taken on a reddish glow. It peered at them with baleful indifference. "Excellent," the man in black said. "How exceptional you are! How methodical! How resourceful! I salute you!" He giggled, and the gunslinger dropped the wood at his feet with a crash that ballooned up bone dust. The man in black did not start or jump. He merely began laying the fire. The gunslinger watched, fascinated, as the ideogram, fresh this time, took shape. When it was finished, it resembled a small and complex double chimney about 2 feet high. The man in black lifted his hand skyward, shaking back the voluminous sleeve from a tapered, handsome hand, and brought it down rapidly, index and pinky fingers forked out in the traditional sign of the evil eye. There was a blue flash of flame, and their fire was lighted. "I have matches," the man in black said jovially, "but I thought you might enjoy the magic. For a pretty gunslinger. Now, cook our dinner." The folds of his robe shivered, and the plucked and gutted carcass of a plump rabbit fell on the dirt. The gunslinger spitted the rabbit wordlessly and roasted it. A savory smell drifted up as the sun went down. Purple shadows drifted hungrily over the bowl where the man in black had chosen to finally face him. The gunslinger felt hunger begin to rumble endlessly in his belly as the rabbit browned, but when the meat was cooked and its juices sealed in, he handed the entire skewer wordlessly to the man in black, rummaged in his own nearly flat knapsack, and withdrew the last of his jerky. It was salty, painful to his mouth, and tasted like tears. "That's a worthless gesture," the man in black said, managing to sound angry and amused at the same time. Nevertheless, the gunslinger said. There were tiny sores in his mouth, the result of vitamin deprivation, and the salt taste made him grin bitterly.
Are you afraid of enchanted meat?
Yes, indeed. The man in black slipped his hood back. The gunslinger looked at him silently. In a way, the face that the hood had hidden was an uneasy disappointment. It was handsome and regular, with none of the marks and twists which indicate a man who has been through awesome times and has been privy to great secrets. His hair was black and of a ragged, matted length. His forehead was high, his eyes dark and brilliant. His nose was nondescript. The lips were full and sensual. His complexion was pallid, as was the gunslinger's own. The gunslinger said finally, "I expected an older man."
"Why? I am nearly immortal, as are you, Roland, for now at least. I could have taken a face with which you would have been more familiar, but I elected to show you the one I was, born with. See, gunslinger, the sunset."
The sun had departed already, and the western sky was filled with sullen furnace light.
"You won't see another sunrise for what may seem a very long time," the man in black said.
The gunslinger remembered the pit under the mountains and then looked at the sky, where the constellations sprawled in clock-spring profusion. "It doesn't matter," he said softly, "now." Two. The man in black shuffled the cards with flying hands. The deck was huge, the designs on the back convoluted.
"These are tarot cards, gunslinger, of a sort. A mixture of the standard deck to which have been added a selection of my own development. Now watch carefully."
"What will I watch?"
"I'm going to tell your future. Seven cards must be turned one at a time and placed in conjunction with the others. I've not done this since the days when Gilead stood and the ladies played at points on the West Lawn, and I suspect I've never read a tale such as yours."
Mockery was creeping into his voice again.
"You are the world's last adventurer, the last crusader. How that must please you, Roland.
Yet you have no idea how close you stand to the tower now as you resume your quest. Worlds turn about your head."
"What do you mean, resume? I never left off."
At this the man in black laughed heartily, but would not say what he found so funny.
"Read my fortune, then," Roland said harshly.
The first card was turned. "The Hanged Man," the man in black said. The darkness had given him back his hood. "Yet here, in conjunction with nothing else, it signifies strength, not death. You, gunslinger, are the Hanged Man, plodding ever onward toward your goal over the pits of Na'ar. You've already dropped one co-traveler into that pit, have you not?"
The gunslinger said nothing, and the second card was turned.
"The sailor! Note the clear brow, the hairless cheeks, the wounded eyes. He drowns, gunslinger, and no one throws out the line. The boy, Jake." The gunslinger winced, said nothing.
The third card was turned. A baboon stood grinningly astride a young man's shoulder. The young man's face was turned up, a grimace of stylized dread and horror on his features. Looking more closely, the gunslinger saw the baboon held a whip.
"The prisoner," the man in black said. The fire cast uneasy, flickering shadows over the face of the ridden man, making it seem to move and writhe in wordless terror. The gunslinger flicked his eyes away.
"A trifle upsetting, isn't he?" the man in black said, and seemed on the verge of sniggering.
He turned the fourth card. A woman with a shawl over her head sat spinning at a wheel. To the gunslinger's dazed eyes, she appeared to be smiling craftily and sobbing at the same time. "The Lady of the Shadows," the man in black remarked. "Does she look two-faced to you, gunslinger?" "She is. Two faces, at least. She broke the blue plate."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know. And in this case, at least," the gunslinger thought his adversary was telling the truth.
"Why are you showing me these?"
"Don't ask," the man in black said sharply, yet he smiled. "Don't ask. Merely watch. Consider this only pointless ritual if it eases you and cools you to do so, like church." He tittered and turned the fifth card. A grinning reaper clutched a scythe with bony fingers.
"Death," the man in black said simply. "Yet not for you."
The sixth card. The gunslinger looked at it and felt a strange, crawling anticipation in his guts. The feeling was mixed with horror and joy, and the whole of the emotion was unnameable. It made him feel like throwing up and dancing at the same time.
"The tower," the man in black said softly. "Here is the tower."
The gunslinger's card occupied the center of the pattern. Each of the following four stood at one corner like satellites circling a star.
"Where does that one go?" the gunslinger asked.
The man in black placed the tower over the hanged man, covering it completely.
"What does that mean?"
the gunslinger asked. The man in black did not answer.
"What does that mean?" he asked raggedly.
The man in black did not answer.
"God damn you!"
No answer.
"Then be damned to you. What's the seventh card?"
The man in black turned the seventh. A sun rose in a luminously blue sky. Cupids and sprites sported around it. Below the sun was a great red field upon which it shone. Roses or blood? The gunslinger could not tell.
"Perhaps," he thought, "it's both."
"The seventh card is life," the man in black said softly. "But not for you."
"Where does it fit the pattern?"
"That is not for you to know now," the man in black said, "or for me to know. I'm not the great one you seek, Roland. I am merely his emissary." He flipped the card carelessly into the dying fire. It charred, curled, and flashed to flame. The gunslinger felt his heart quail and turn icy in his chest.
"Sleep now," the man in black said carelessly. "Perchance to dream and that sort of thing."
"What my bullets won't do, mayhap my hands will," the gunslinger said. His legs coiled with savage, splendid suddenness, and he flew across the fire at the other, arms outstretched. The man in black, smiling, swelled in his vision and then retreated down a long and echoing corridor. The world filled with the sound of sardonic laughter. He was falling, dying, sleeping. He dreamed.
3. The universe was void. Nothing moved. Nothing was. The gunslinger drifted, bemused.
"Let's have a little light," the voice of the man in black said nonchalantly, and there was light.
The gunslinger thought in a detached way that light was pretty good.
Now darkness overhead with stars in it, water down below.
It happened. He drifted over endless seas. Above, the stars twinkled endlessly, yet he saw none of the constellations which had guided him across his long life.
"Land," the man in black invited, and there was. It heaved itself out of the water in endless galvanic convulsions.
It was red, arid, cracked, and glazed with sterility. Volcanoes blurted endless magma like giant pimples on some ugly adolescent's baseball head.
"Okay," the man in black was saying, "that's a start. Let's have some plants, trees,
grass and fields. There was. Dinosaurs rambled here and there, growling and woofing and eating each other and getting stuck in bubbling odoriferous tar pits. Huge tropical rainforests sprawled everywhere. Giant ferns waved at the sky with serrated leaves. Beetles with two heads crawled on some of them. All this the gunslinger saw, and yet he felt big. "Now, bring man," the man in black said softly. But the gunslinger was falling, falling up. The horizon of this vast and fecund earth began to curve. Yes, they had all said it curved. His teacher, Vanet, had claimed it had been proved long before the world had moved on. But this, further and further, higher and higher, continents took shape before his amazed eyes and were obscured with clock springs of clouds. The world's atmosphere held it in a placental sack. And the sun, rising beyond the earth's shoulder, he cried out and threw an arm before his eyes. "Let there be light!" The voice no longer belonged to the man in black. It was gigantic, echoing. It filled space and the spaces between space. Light! Falling, falling, the sun shrank. A red planet stamped with canals whirled past him, two moons circling it furiously. Beyond this was a whirling belt of stones and a gigantic planet that seethed with gases, too huge to support itself, oblate in consequence. Further out was a ringed world that glittered like a precious gem within its engirdlement of icy spicules. Light! Let there be other worlds, one, two, three, far beyond the last, one lonely ball of ice and rock, twirled in dead darkness about a sun that glittered no brighter than a tarnished penny. Beyond this, darkness. No, the gunslinger said, and his word on it was flat and echoless in the black. It was darker than dark, blacker than black. Beside this, the darkest night of a man's soul was as noonday, the darkness under the mountains a mere smudge on the face of light. No more, please, no more now, no more, light, no more, please. The stars themselves began to shrink. Whole nebulae drew together and became glowing smudges. The whole universe seemed to be drawing around him. Please, no more, no more, no more. The voice of the man in black whispered silkily in his ear, "Then me neg. Cast away all thoughts of the tower. Go your way, gunslinger, and begin the long job of saving your soul." He gathered himself, shaken and alone, enwrapped in the darkness, terrified of an ultimate meaning rushing at him. He gathered himself and uttered the final answer on that subject. Never. Then let there be light. And there was light, crashing in on him like a hammer, a great and primordial light. Consciousness had no chance of survival in that great glare, but before it perished, the gunslinger saw something clearly, something he believed to be of cosmic importance. He clutched it with agonized effort, and then went deep, seeking refuge in himself before that light should blind his eyes and blast his sanity. He fled the light and the knowledge the light implied, and so came back to himself. Even so do the rest of us. Even so the best of us. 4. It was still night. Whether the same or another, he had no immediate way of knowing. He pushed himself up from where his demon spring at the man in black had carried him, and looked at the ironwood where Walter O'Dim, as some along Roland's way had named him, had been sitting. He was gone. A great sense of despair flooded him. God, all that to do over again. And then the man in black said from behind him, "Over here, gunslinger. I don't like you so close. You talk in your sleep," he tittered. The gunslinger got groggily to his knees and turned around. The fire had burned down to red embers and gray ashes, leaving the familiar decayed pattern of exhausted fuel. The man in black was seated next to it, smacking his lips with unlovely enthusiasm over the greasy remains of the rabbit.
"You did fairly well," the man in black said. "I never could have sent that vision to your father. He would have come back drooling."
"What was it?" the gunslinger asked. His words were blurred and shaky. He felt that if he tried to rise, his legs would buckle.
"The universe,"
the man in black said carelessly. He burped and threw the bones into the fire, where they first glistened and then blackened. The wind above the cup of the Golgotha keened and moaned.
"Universe?"
the gunslinger said blankly. It was a word with which he was unfamiliar. His first thought was that the other was speaking poetry.
"You want the tower?" the man in black said. It seemed to be a question.
"Yes."
"Well, you shan't have it,"
the man in black said, and smiled with bright cruelty.
"No one cares in the councils of the great if you pawn your soul or sell it outright, Roland. I have an idea of how close to the edge that last pushed you. The tower will kill you half a world away."
"You know nothing of me," the gunslinger said quietly, and the smile faded from the other's lips.
"I made your father, and I broke him," the man in black said grimly. "I came to your mother as Martin. There's a truth you always suspected, is it not? And took her. She bent beneath me like a willow. Although, this may comfort you, she never broke. In any case, it was written, and it was. I am the furthest minion of he who now rules the Dark Tower, and earth has been given into that king's red hand."
"Red? Why do you say red?"
"Never mind. We'll not speak of him, although you'll learn more than you cared to if you press on. What hurt you once will hurt you twice. This is not the beginning, but the beginning's end. You'd do well to remember that, but you never do."
"I don't understand."
"No, you don't. You never did. You never will. You have no imagination. You're blind that way."
"What did I see?" the gunslinger asked. "What did I see at the end? What was it?"
"What did it seem to be?"
The gunslinger was silent, thoughtful. He felt for his tobacco, but there was none. The man in black did not offer to refill his poke by either black magic or white. Later he might find more in his grow-bag, but later seemed very far away now.
"There was light," the gunslinger said finally. "Great white light, and then—"
He broke off and stared at the man in black. He was leaning forward, and an alien emotion was stamped on his face, writ too large for lies or denial. It was awe or wonder. Perhaps they were the same.
"You don't know," he said, and began to smile. "O great sorcerer who brings the dead to life, you don't know. You're a fake."
"I know," the man in black said. "But I don't know what."
"White light,"
the gunslinger repeated, and then "a blade of grass. One single blade of grass that filled everything, and I was tiny, infinitesimal."
"Grass?"
The man in black closed his eyes. His face looked drawn and haggard.
"A blade of grass. Are you sure?"
"Yes,"
the gunslinger frowned, "but it was purple."
"Hear me now, Roland, son of Stephen. Would you hear me?"
"Yes."
And so the man in black began to speak. 5. "The universe," he said, "is the great all, and offers a paradox too great for the finite mind to grasp. As the living brain cannot conceive of a non-living brain, although it may think it can, the finite mind cannot grasp the infinite. The prosaic fact of the universe's existence alone defeats both the pragmatist and the romantic. There was a time, yet 100 generations before the world moved on, when mankind had achieved enough technical and scientific prowess to chip a few splinters from the great stone pillar of reality. Even so, the false light of science, knowledge if you like, shone in only a few developed countries. One company, or cabal, led the way in this regard, North Central Positronics, it called itself. Yet, despite a tremendous increase in available facts, there were remarkably few insights.
Gunslinger, our many times great-grandfathers conquered the disease which rots, which they called cancer, almost conquered aging, walked on the moon.
I don't believe that, the gunslinger said flatly. To this the man in black merely smiled and answered, "You needn't."
Yet it was so. They made or discovered 100 other marvelous baubles.
But this wealth of information produced little or no insight. There were no great odes written to the wonders of artificial insemination, having babies from frozen man-sperm, or to the cars that ran on power from the sun. Few, if any, seemed to have grasped the truest principle of reality. New knowledge leads always to yet more awesome mysteries. Greater physiological knowledge of the brain makes the existence of the soul less possible, yet more probable by the nature of the search. Do you see? Of course you don't. You've reached the limits of your ability to comprehend. But never mind, that's beside the point.
What is the point, then?
The greatest mystery the universe offers is not life, but size. Size encompasses life, and the tower encompasses size. The child who is most at home with wonder says, "Daddy, what is above the sky?" And the father says, "The darkness of space." The child, "What is beyond space?" The father, "The galaxy." The child, "Beyond the galaxy?" The father, "Another galaxy." The child, "Beyond the other galaxies." The father, "No one knows." You see? Size defeats us. For the fish, the lake in which he lives, is the universe. What does the fish think when he is jerked up by the mouth through the silver limits of existence and into a new universe where the air drowns him and the light is blue madness? Where huge bipeds with no gills stuff it into a suffocating box and cover it with wet weeds to die. Or one might take the tip of a pencil and magnify it. One reaches the point where a stunning realization strikes home. The pencil tip is not solid. It is composed of atoms which whirl and revolve like a trillion demon planets. What seems solid to us is actually only a loose net held together by gravity. Viewed at their actual size, the distances between these atoms might become leagues, gulfs, eons. The atoms themselves are composed of nuclei and revolving protons and electrons. One may step down further to subatomic particles and then to what? Tachyons? Nothing? Of course not. Everything in the universe denies nothing. To suggest an ending is the one absurdity. If you fell outward to the limit of the universe, would you find a board fence and signs reading "Dead End"? No. You might find something hard and rounded, as the chick must see the egg from the inside. And if you should peck through that shell or find a door, what great and torrential light might shine through your opening at the end of space? Might you look through and discover our entire universe is but part of one atom on a blade of grass? Might you be forced to think that by burning a twig you incinerate an eternity of eternities? That existence rises not to one infinite, but to an infinity of them. Perhaps you saw what place our universe plays in the scheme of things as no more than an atom in a blade of grass. Could it be that everything we can perceive, from the microscopic virus to the distant Horsehead Nebula, is contained in one blade of grass that may have existed for only a single season in an alien time flow? What if that blade should be cut off by a scythe? When it begins to die, would the rot seep into our own universe and our own lives, turning everything yellow and brown and desiccated? Perhaps it's already begun to happen. We say the world has moved on. Maybe we really mean that it has begun to dry up. Think how small such a concept of things makes us, gunslinger. If a god watches over it all, does he actually mete out justice for a race of gnats among an infinitude of races of gnats? Does his eye see the sparrow fall when the sparrow is less than a speck of hydrogen floating disconnected in the depth of space? And if he does see, what must the nature of such a god be? Where does he live? How is it possible to live beyond infinity? Imagine the sand of the Mohane Desert, which you crossed to find me. And imagine a trillion universes, not worlds, but universes, encapsulated in each grain of that desert. And within each university, an infinity of others. We tower over these universes from our pitiful grass vantage point. With one swing of your boot, you may knock a billion, billion worlds flying off into darkness, in a chain never to be completed. Sighs, gunslinger. Sighs. Yet suppose further. Suppose that all worlds, all universes, met in a single nexus, a single pylon, a tower. And within it, a stairway, perhaps rising to the Godhead itself. Would you dare climb to the top, gunslinger? Could it be that somewhere above all of endless reality there exists a room? You dare not. And in the gunslinger's mind, those words echoed. You dare not. Six. Someone has dared, the gunslinger said.
Who would that be?
God, the gunslinger said softly. His eyes gleamed. God has dared. Or the king you spoke of, or... Is the room empty, seer?
I don't know.
Fear passed over the man in black's bland face, as soft and dark as a buzzard's wing.
And furthermore, I don't ask. It might be unwise.
Afraid of being struck dead?
Perhaps afraid of an accounting.
The man in black was silent for a while. The night was very long. The Milky Way sprawled above them in great splendor, yet terrifying in the emptiness between its burning lamps. The gunslinger wondered what he would feel if that inky sky should split open and let in a torrent of light. "The fire," he said. "I'm cold."
"Build it up yourself," said the man in black. "It's the butler's night off."
7. The gunslinger drowsed a while and awoke to see the man in black regarding him avidly, unhealthily. "What are you staring at?" An old saying of Court's occurred to him. "Do you see your sister's bum?"
"I'm staring at you, of course."
"Well, don't!" He poked up the fire, ruining the precision of the ideogram. "I don't like it." He looked to the east to see if there was the beginning of light, but this night went on and on.
"You seek the light so soon."
"I was made for light."
"Ah, so you were. And so impolite of me to forget the fact. Yet we have much to discuss yet, you and I. For so has it been told to me by my king and master."
"Who is this king?" The man in black smiled.
"Shall we tell the truth, then, you and I? No more lies?
I thought we had been. But the man in black persisted, as if Roland hadn't spoken. Shall there be truth between us as two men? Not as friends, but as equals. There is an offer you will get rarely, Roland. Only equals speak the truth. That's my thought on it. Friends and lovers lie endlessly, caught in the web of regard. How tiresome. Well, I wouldn't want to tire you, so let us speak the truth. He had never spoken less on this night. Start by telling me what exactly you mean by glamour.
Why, enchantment, gunslinger. My king's enchantment has prolonged this night and will prolong it until our palaver is done.
How long will that be?
Long. I can tell you no better. I do not know myself.
The man in black stood over the fire, and the glowing embers made patterns on his face.
Ask. I will tell you what I know. You have caught me. It is fair. I did not think you would, yet your quest has only begun. Ask. It will lead us to business soon enough.
Who is your king?
I have never seen him. But you must. But before you meet him, you must first meet the ageless stranger.
The man in black smiled spitelessly.
You must slay him, gunslinger, yet I think it is not what you wished to ask.
If you've never seen your king and master, how do you know him?
He comes to me in dreams. As a stripling, he came to me when I lived poor and unknown in a far land. A sheaf of centuries ago, he imbued me with my duty and promised me my reward, although there were many errands in my youth and the days of my manhood before my apotheosis. You are that apotheosis, gunslinger. You are my climax.
He tittered.
You see, someone has taken you seriously.
And this stranger, does he have a name?
Oh, he is named.
And what is his name?
Legion, the man in black said softly. And somewhere in the easterly darkness where the mountains lay, a rock slide punctuated his words, and a puma screamed like a woman. The gunslinger shivered, and the man in black flinched. Yet I do not think that is what you wished to ask either. It is not your nature to think so far ahead.
The gunslinger knew the question. It had gnawed him all this night, and he thought for years before. It trembled on his lips, but he didn't ask it, not yet. This stranger is a minion of the tower, like yourself?
Yar, he darkles, he tinkts. He is in all times, yet there is one greater than he.
Who?
Ask me no more,
the man in black cried. His voice aspired to sternness and crumbled into beseechment.
I know not. I do not wish to know. To speak of the things in Endworld is to speak of the ruination of one's own soul.
And beyond the ageless stranger is the tower, and whatever the tower contains?
Yes, whispered the man in black. But none of these things are what you wish to ask.
True. All right, the gunslinger said, and then asked the world's oldest question. Will I succeed? Will I win through?
If I answered that question, gunslinger, you'd kill me.
I ought to kill you. You need killing. His hands had dropped to the worn butts of his guns.
Those do not open doors, gunslinger. Those only close them forever.
Where must I go?
Start west. Go to the sea. Where the world ends is where you must begin. There was a man who gave you advice. The man you bested so long ago.
Yes, court, the gunslinger interrupted impatiently.
The advice was to wait. It was bad advice. For even then my plans against your father had proceeded. He sent you away, and when you returned,
I'd not hear you speak of that, the gunslinger said. And in his mind he heard his mother singing, Baby Bunting, baby dear, baby bring your basket here.
Then hear this.
When you returned, Martin had gone west to join the rebels. So all said, anyway, and so you believed. Yet he and a certain witch left you a trap, and you fell into it. Good boy, and although Martin was long gone by then, there was a man who sometimes made you think of him, was there not? A man who affected the dress of a monk and the shaven head of a penitent. Walter, the gunslinger whispered. And although he had come so far in his musings, the bald truth still amazed him. You. Martin never left at all. The man in black tittered. At your service. I ought to kill you now.
That would hardly be fair. Besides, all of that was long ago. Now comes the time of sharing.
You never left, the gunslinger repeated, stunned. You only changed.
Sit, the man in black invited. I'll tell you stories, as many as you would hear. Your own stories, I think, will be much longer.
I don't talk of myself, the gunslinger muttered.
Yet tonight you must, so that we may understand.
Understand what? My purpose? You know that. To find the tower is my purpose. I'm sworn.
Not your purpose, gunslinger. Your mind. Your slow, prodding, tenacious mind. There has never been one quite like it in all the history of the world, perhaps in the history of creation. This is the time of speaking. This is the time of histories.
Then speak.
The man in black shook the voluminous arm of his robe. A foil-wrapped package fell out and caught the dying embers in many reflective folds.
Tobacco, gunslinger.
Would you smoke?
He had been able to resist the rabbit, but he could not resist this. He opened the foil with eager fingers. There was fine, crumbled tobacco inside, and green leaves to wrap it in, amazingly moist. He had not seen such tobacco for 10 years. He rolled 2 cigarettes and bit the ends of each to release the flavor. He offered one to the man in black, who took it. Each of them took a burning twig from the fire. The gunslinger lit his cigarette and drew the aromatic smoke deep into his lungs, closing his eyes to concentrate the senses. He blew out with long, slow satisfaction.
"Is it good?" the man in black inquired.
"Yes, very good."
"Enjoy it. It may be the last smoke for you in a very long time."
The gunslinger took this impassively.
"Very well," the man in black said. "To begin, then. You must understand the tower has always been, and there have always been boys who know of it and lust for it, more than power or riches or women. Boys who look for the doors that lead to it."
8. There was talk then, a night's worth of talk, and God alone knew how much more, or how much was true, but the gunslinger remembered little of it later. And to his oddly practical mind, little of it seemed to matter. The man in black told him again that he must go to the sea, which lay no more than 20 easy miles to the west, and there he would be invested with the power of drawing. "But that's not exactly right either," the man in black said, pitching his cigarette into the remains of the campfire. "No one wants to invest you with a power of any kind, gunslinger. It is simply in you. And I am compelled to tell you, partly because of the sacrifice of a boy, and partly because it is the law, the natural law of things. Water must run downhill, and you must be told. You will draw 3, I understand, but I don't really care, and I don't really want to know."
"The 3,
the gunslinger murmured, thinking of the oracle.
"And then the fun begins, but by then I'll be long gone. Goodbye, gunslinger. My part is done now. The chain is still in your hands. Where it doesn't wrap itself around your neck."
Compelled by something outside him, Roland said,
You have one more thing to say, don't you?
Yes, the man in black said. And he smiled at the gunslinger with his depthless eyes and stretched one of his hands out toward him. Let there be light.
And there was light. And this time, the light was good.
9. Roland awoke by the ruins of the campfire to find himself 10 years older. His black hair had thinned at the temples, and there had gone the gray of cobwebs at the end of autumn. The lines in his face were deeper, his skin rougher. The remains of the wood he had carried had turned to something like stone, and the man in black was a laughing skeleton in a rotting black robe. More bones in this place of bones, one more skull in this Golgotha.
Or is it really you? He thought. I have my doubts, Walter O'Dim. I have my doubts, Martin that was.
He stood up and looked around. Then, with a sudden quick gesture, he reached toward the remains of his companion of the night before, if it was indeed the remains of Walter, a night that had somehow lasted 10 years. He broke off the grinning jawbone and jammed it carelessly into the left hip pocket of his jeans, a fitting enough replacement for the one lost under the mountains.
"How many lies did you tell me?" he asked.
Many, he was sure. But what made them good lies was that they had been mixed with the truth.
The tower.
Somewhere ahead, it waited for him. The nexus of time. The nexus of size. He began west again, his back set against the sunrise, heading toward the ocean, realizing that a great passage of his life had come and gone.
I loved you, Jake, he said, aloud.
The stiffness wore out of his body, and he began to walk more rapidly. By that evening he had come to the end of the land. He sat on a beach, which stretched left and right forever, deserted. The waves beat endlessly against the shore, pounding and pounding. The setting sun painted the water in a wide strip of fool's gold. There, the gunslinger sat, his face turned up into the fading light. He dreamed his dreams, and watched as the stars came out. His purpose did not flag, nor did his heart falter. His hair, finer now, and gray at the temples, blew around his head, and the sandalwood-inlaid guns of his father lay smooth and deadly against his hips. And he was lonely, but did not find loneliness in any way a bad or ignoble thing. The dark came down, and the world moved on. The gunslinger waited for the time of the drawing, and dreamed his long dreams of the dark tower, to which he would some day come at dusk and approach, winding his horn, to do some unimaginable final battle. This is George Guidel. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Dark Tower, Book One, The Gunslinger. This program was directed by Lynn Ellington and produced by Claudia Howard. The executive producer was Patty Peruse. The Dark Tower, Book One, The Gunslinger, is a production of Penguin Audiobooks and Recorded Books, LLC. Copyright 2003, all rights reserved. The book The Dark Tower, Book One, The Gunslinger, is available wherever Viking books are sold.